We are at another crossroads. We can either continue to stand for free expression, understanding its messiness, but believing that the long journey towards greater progress requires confronting ideas that challenge us. Or we can decide that the cost is simply too great. And I'm here today because I believe that we must continue to stand for free expression.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg defending his company's handling of political ads in a speech at Georgetown University last week. We'll talk about why his defense may not be good enough for lawmakers as the 2020 election approaches. First, though, more closed-door testimony today in the impeachment saga. William Taylor, the acting ambassador to Ukraine, testified behind closed doors before three House committees, giving what lawmakers described as damning testimony, saying he was told Trump wanted Ukraine aid to be contingent on an investigation of the Bidens and the 2016 election. In the coming days, more testimony from other officials in the federal government. The investigation is now a month old and a lot of information is coming out, but it can seem like a lot to make sense of it all. Well, here to help us out is Paula Reed, White House correspondent for CBS News. Hi.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so what have we learned so far today from Ambassador Taylor's testimony?
So we've heard a lot from the members who were actually in this hearing. There were apparently audible gasps during former Ambassador Taylor's opening statement, and it appears that he really corroborates a lot of what's been out there in the public record. He expressed in text messages that he was concerned that aid to the Ukraine was being withheld in an effort to press the Ukraine's government to pursue political investigations on behalf of President Trump. Now, it's interesting. We're hearing from the folks who were in this hearing that Taylor was a very good note taker. He's a career public servant, and apparently he was very diligent, took very good notes, and that's really helping him provide this accounting to lawmakers.
I think his word actually was crazy, right? That it would
yes,
be crazy
that was
to
one
withhold
of the words
aid.
He used, exactly.
Yeah. So how does he contradict or reinforce previous testimony, especially from Trump's ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland?
That's right. Well, it appears, look, the ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, he's going to have some explaining to do because he repeatedly told lawmakers, were told that he did not recall about a lot of the incidents he was asked about. But now Taylor has been able to sort of flush out the record and some of these key moments in the investigation. So they can, if they want to, try to go back at the ambassador to try to get him maybe on the record with some more coherent answers.
Right. So the two of them had text messages, right? Taylor and Sondland had text messages between the two of them. And then at one point, Sondland said, there is absolutely no quid pro quo here. The president says there's no quid pro quo, which I guess Democrats are saying looks a little suspicious, like he was just writing that text to cover himself.
Absolutely. And if you read that text, it reads like something a lawyer would have drafted. It doesn't read the way the president speaks, and it doesn't really match Sondland's other communications in that conversation. So there are questions about whether he took these concerns back to the White House, if he consulted attorneys, and how he came to suddenly just drop back into the conversation and say, wait a second, there's no quid pro quo.
All right. So given all of the testimony that has happened so far and all of the leaked opening statements that we've received, what kind of overall picture are you putting together?
Well, it seems that this is inevitable. I mean, even the president's attorneys tell me this. They say we're pretty sure that he is likely to be impeached in the House. It appears that they're painting a pretty damning picture, and these are not a lot of partisan actors here. A lot of the folks they've brought before this committee, these are civil servants. These are people who have had long careers either in foreign service or the civil service. These are people who would come across as pretty credible witnesses. It does appear that they're putting on a robust case. But the White House officials, they're crying foul. You know, they're telling me just a few hours ago, they're saying, hey, there isn't sufficient due process here for the president. And when I ask them, what does due process look like? They point to the letter that the White House counsel sent to House Democrats a week or so ago, where they say he wants a vote and he wants to be able to cross-examine witnesses. They want access to all of these documents. They want to be more a part of the process. So they're trying to undermine its credibility because even as they've told me, they believe this is inevitable, that the president will likely be impeached in the House. Now, what happens in the Senate, that's still an open question. It's not expected that he would be removed from office.
Right. But that's not really how an impeachment process works, letting the subject of the investigation cross-examine witnesses.
Exactly. But this is their definition of due process. They're insisting that there needs to be a vote to formalize the impeachment inquiry before they'll even recognize it or allow witnesses to testify. Now, we know there's nothing in the Constitution requiring a vote on an impeachment inquiry. And it's been interesting in their efforts to try to block some of these witnesses. I'll use Fiona Hill, the former Russia advisor, as an example. We obtained the letters from the White House counsel where they specifically said she can't testify. We're asserting executive privilege. This is blocked. And her lawyers wrote back and said, no, executive privilege doesn't apply if there's misconduct. Well, okay, that was the end of it. She went and she testified. So it appears that this defense that they're trying to put on, it's not terribly robust. You're able to drive right through it. And so far, I mean, legally, politically, in terms of communications, there is not really a cohesive or coherent defense strategy coming out of the White House to combat this ongoing investigation that just keeps going and going.
Right. So it's been about a month now. When do we expect this to wrap up?
It feels like a year.
It's
my understanding that in terms of going through with articles of impeachment, all of that, the deadline that has been sort of floating out there has been between Thanksgiving and Christmas. But the more it's like any investigation, every time you turn over a rock, you never know what you're going to find. It could take lawmakers longer to pursue this. But they also know the public doesn't necessarily have an indefinite appetite for this kind of investigation. But so far, it appears that if we're talking about drafting articles of impeachment and voting on them, around the holidays, between Thanksgiving and Christmas, is what has been floated by lawmakers, but it's not set in stone.
Okay. Well, speaking of the public, where is the public on this?
Well, the most recent CBS News poll shows that the majority of Americans do support an impeachment inquiry. Now, that's different than saying that they want the president impeached, although those numbers are slowly creeping up as well. It does appear over the past month or so, the questions about Ukraine have tipped public opinion towards wanting this fact-finding mission. Now, but you hear the president, he tries to spin this as, no, this is good for me, impeach me, the voters will see it, I'm a victim. They want lawmakers to focus on prescription drugs and opioids. He said that just last night on Fox News. But if you look at the polls, in fact, the majority of Americans, they do support an impeachment inquiry.
Right. I think today he said that he was the subject of a lynching, which, of course, has gotten a lot of blowback, his use of that word.
It has. And I was at the White House when he sent that tweet. One of his spokesmen, Hogan Gidley, came out and he took questions from reporters, did not envy him for having to defend this tweet. But he really couldn't explain it. He couldn't defend it. He really couldn't even put it in any kind of acceptable context. He was really grilled by reporters about why that's acceptable. I asked him why the president constantly circles back to racial animus and these dark chapters of American history, chapters that are very painful for many people. Why would you bring that up in the context of an impeachment? There's just no good explanation for this, but we've seen this in the past. Or sometimes to create a distraction, the president will bring up very painful moments in our history to change the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Right. And even Senator Mitch McConnell criticized his use of that word, lynching.
He did. Although it was interesting, Senator Lindsey Graham, one of the president's closest allies, did come to his defense on using that term. But for the most part, it's been bipartisan consensus that this is not an appropriate term to apply to himself for a constitutionally enshrined process that he's going through.
Well, speaking of bipartisan, we're not seeing bipartisan agreement on this impeachment inquiry at all. But there are some cracks. We're seeing some cracks, some Republicans questioning the president. Do you expect to see more of that?
It depends. I think part of why you saw the president in a rare reversal, sort of change course on the idea of hosting the G7 at his resort in Florida, is because he knew he just could not take on Republicans on another theater, right? He needs their support in the impeachment inquiry. There's already a wave of bipartisan criticism over his decision to abruptly withdraw in Syria. He needs to make sure, and the White House needs to make sure, that they keep Republican support, particularly in the Senate, in his corner and on his side. But you see, for example, with Senator Mitt Romney, he was critical of Mick Mulvaney, acting chief of staff Mick Mulvaney's press conference last week. And yesterday, the president was praising Democrats, how they stick together. They don't have a, quote, Mitt Romney in their midst. He's still going out there and throwing some punches at some of these potential Republicans who could potentially flip on him. So I wouldn't hazard a guess about whether or not he's got them all locked down. But it's clear from the fact that he reversed course on the G7 that he knows he needs Republican support and he just can't do battle with them on anything beyond impeachment.
Well, Paula, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Paula Reid, CBS White House correspondent. Coming up, why Facebook is being investigated for antitrust violations by most of the states in the United States, most except for California. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg is going to Congress tomorrow. He's expected to testify about his plans to create a cryptocurrency. It's called Libra. But while he's there, he is also expected to face a lot of other questions on Russian, Chinese, and Iranian efforts to interfere in the 2020 election, and on a big antitrust investigation nearly every state attorney general has signed on to. With us to break it all down is Mike Isaac, tech reporter with the New York Times. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, first, let's talk about this antitrust investigation. New York is leading it. 46 other states have joined. What's the main argument?
I mean, look, I think for Facebook, you know, for the past, let's say, 15 years since they've been around, most of the federal organizations that were supposed to check big tech's power have really kind of been asleep at the wheel. And it seems like most of the acquisitions that have gone through, whether it's Facebook's acquisition of Instagram or WhatsApp, have not been closely scrutinized. And I think now, you know, the FTC and the DOJ and state attorneys general are basically saying, look, you know, we may not have scrutinized these hard enough at the time, and now we're looking retroactively to see if they should still go through, because Facebook essentially has a lock on all of social networking, at least in much of the developed world.
Mm-hmm. Well, notably absent from this lawsuit is the great state of California, in which Facebook is located. California also absent from the other big antitrust investigation the state's launched against Google. Mm. So what's the reasoning behind that?
I think it's still sort of in progress and in motion. I'm not sure if they're going to sort of later sort of jump on board. Maybe it's like willing to feel out the how politically expedient this move is right now. And some of these seem like picking battles, or, you know, what might play well with constituents. And it's interesting because right now I do think going after big tech is a popular position politically on both sides of the aisle. You see Democrats like Warren going after them, as well as President Trump kind of swinging for very different reasons. But it's still pretty, I think it scores points with the public to beat up on big tech. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the 2020 election. And Zuckerberg said that, yeah, he's noticing that there's already campaigns put out by state actors in Russia, Iran, China to disrupt the 2020 election. What is he doing about that?
Yeah, you know, I feel like 2016 really sort of, you know, Russia was the first to really, I want to say, pioneer this form of election manipulation, or at least social engineering, where they where bad actors kind of spread misinformation to sow like discord between American citizens. And so, you know, once we discovered that, once the government and Facebook started doing things, I think that actually started spreading to other nation states as like a way to mess with governments and democratic elections. So Facebook is trying to position themselves as like, look, we're doing as much as we can. We have 35,000 people working on this problem. We're spending billions, more than our entire 2012 revenue on security alone. They made some changes yesterday, like labeling state-sponsored media pages, so people might, you know if, let's say, Russia Today, which is largely controlled by the government, has something to say about, you know, or has a hand in the news being created. So they're making small tweaks, But at the same time, there's a tension because Mark Zuckerberg doesn't want to control or be the arbiter of what speech is really allowed on his platform. So it's a really tough problem for them.
Right. And he said as much in that interview yesterday with NBC. He has been criticized for not taking down an ad that falsely states that Joe Biden withheld $1 billion from Ukraine to benefit his son. That ad, I believe, put out by the Trump campaign. Is that right?
Yeah, Trump campaign or some of his backers, like someone in Trump's orbit. That's right.
Okay, so that ad's been viewed millions of times on Facebook. It's obviously not true. And here's what Zuckerberg says about that.
I believe that that it is important for people to be able to hear and see what politicians are saying. I think that when they do that, that speech will be heavily scrutinized by other journalists, by other people.
So he says that that's the reason why he's keeping up something that is a blatant lie on Facebook.
Yeah, I think I guess to be fair to Facebook, this has been at least some tech companies' hard line for a little while. Twitter for the past basically 3 years has been asked why they don't take down President Trump's account, considering he breaks some of their rules. But I think the tech companies are in this difficult position where, look, they may, you know, politicians of all, you know, sizes and statures may be breaking some of the fundamental rules of the platform, but do you cover it or do you allow it when it is a newsworthy situation, when they are, you know, if essentially you are their constituents and you elect them to represent you? So it's, you know, big tech and especially Facebook doesn't want to be the arbiter of what should and shouldn't be said. It's kind of the last place they want to be in. So I think right now they're waiting to, sort of a weird position for them because they actually want to be regulated, because then they can kind of pass that buck to the government by saying, look, this is, we're following the government regulations that are being told to us, so we don't actually have to do the deciding.
Interesting. Well, it should be noted that some of the major broadcast outlets, networks, have refused to air that ad.
Yep, that's right. I mean, look, I think all sort of publishers, platforms, broadcasters right now are trying to decide what that line in the sand is. And CNN in particular made a big stand on saying, no, we're not going to air this. It's unclear to me. I mean, look, I honestly don't know what the right answer to this is. I think there's probably good arguments on both sides of it, just because, you know, do you want to proliferate lies on the biggest platform in the world? That can be dangerous. But also, where is the line between what is and is acceptable on here? And that's also hard to tell. So it's not a position I would want to be in, I guess.
Right. And I guess there's just so much more content than broadcast networks have to deal with when you're talking about a social media network.
Yeah, at least if you're a CNN or MSNBC or something like that, or even, you know, a radio station, you can at least have a, it's not like the water faucet of content is overflowing, but with Facebook, it's like a fire hose where billions of people post, you know, tens of billions of things every single day. So there's absolutely no way, you know, even if they wanted to, they couldn't clamp down on all of it just because it's not possible.
Well, I guess they could not take political advertising. That could be one thing.
Yeah, that's one. I think that's one sort of way out. Zuckerberg even said, like, look, the amount of revenue we make on this is really not worth the amount of controversy we get around it. But I think their reasoning is, they consider it part of voice, which is probably debatable. And then B, is that another slippery slope we want to go down? You know, if what's a political ad versus an issue versus something that people just want to start talking about. So they are, they're like, we'll rather take the heat right now than get into another different debate when we start having to take down political ads.
Mike Isaac is a tech reporter with the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Coming up, Paul Rudd stars in a new TV show as a guy named Miles, who's cloned. The clone, a better version of the real Miles.
So he'd walk off set as new Miles, come back 10 minutes later with the makeup gone, and then he'd be Miles. And I swear, like, it looks like his whole jawline is different, and he just looks like a completely different person.
I'll speak with the creator of the new show, Living With Yourself, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time for TV on the Radio.
Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose.
Oh my God, they've killed Kenny!
Three words for you. Treat, yo, so.
I am the one who knocks.
That's what she said.
Well, today, a story about a man in a rut. His marriage is falling apart. His career is stagnant. Then he hears about an exclusive spa where you can emerge the best version of yourself.
The path of life brings us many troubles. Sadness, fear, humiliation, pain, short telomeres, bad DNA, old body, old chemical, bad life. Our exclusive process. Rebuild your DNA better than ever. A better you. The best you can be.
Well, it turns out the best you can be is not, strictly speaking, you.
Cloning?
Ultra-rapid cloning, plus microsynaptic memory transfer.
Wait, you cloned me?
There you go. You hit the nail right on the head.
Well, that's from the new Netflix series, Living With Yourself. It stars Paul Rudd and... Paul Rudd. It's written and created by Timothy Greenberg, who joins me now in the studio. Hi.
Hi.
So Paul Rudd plays himself and his clone, and you've kind of inverted the evil twin soap opera cliche to be the evil twin is actually the better twin.
Yeah.
The good twin.
That's right. Yes.
But also that can be kind of creepy too.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that if you were presented with the best version of yourself, well, I mean, aside from being terrifying and creepy, that it would be very difficult to feel like I'm not living up to that person over there. And why can't I be like that person? Which I think we do ourselves, just in that imagined version.
You're jealous of yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Jealous of, and you're just like, why can't I be that person? Because sometimes it exists, but why can't I do it right now, you know? I think it'd be very difficult, yeah.
So he is, Miles is the character's name. Mm-hmm. He, when we first meet him, he is really in bad shape. He's really failing at life.
Yeah, yeah. He's, you know, we sort of find out a bit why later, but he's stuck. Things have not worked out the way that he thought they would. And he's, you know, I think of it as like he's in a hole, but it's a hole of his own making. You know, he really... He's got a great situation if you want to look at it one way. You know, he's got a nice house and he's got a, it seems like a wonderful wife and he's got a good job. But, you know, he doesn't see it that way and he's not feeling it that way. And so I think his view of the world is really, you know, of what should be a good world is really colored by his, I don't know if you want to call it depression or whatever it is, his mental state there. Yeah.
Just like too much success has made him.
I think, I mean, really, very specifically, you know, I don't know if we ever get to it, but like he had some early success and thought, okay, this is what it's going to be like. And then it never happened again. And that was true in his relationship with his wife. It was true at work. It was just true in general that he's just not at all the person that he thought he would be when his short story starts.
So this is a feeling a lot of us have, right?
Yeah.
When we're kind of hurtling towards midlife.
Yeah.
Like things aren't really panning out the way we had fantasized that they would.
Yeah.
And it does seem very attractive to go into a spa, albeit in a crummy mini mall like this one is,
yeah.
and emerge a totally, you know, shedding your skin, if you will, literally, I guess, in this case.
Yeah, I if somebody, I'm sure a lot of us have said, here's a treatment that could make you the best version of yourself. Would you do it?
Which happens all the time, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, once I started doing, you know, kind of, what its little line is, like, you know, the best you can be. I started noticing walking around New York City where I live, that's all over the place. You know, I see them on signs in the windows. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's a very common pitch, like this will make you the best you can be.
Yeah. And you see it here in LA all the time, of course, with
all
these wellness trends and up in Silicon Valley where people want to live to be 1,000 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. If there was future versions of the story, I would very much want to see what the LA version of this cloning spa is and you know, how that's different from the one that we have in the show. I think it would be fun to play with that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think what's also interesting is how they relate to each other, the two.
Mm-hmm.
Because, the original Paul Rudd character, the loser, is a little jealous of the clone, but the clone is also jealous of him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I think one of the things that makes the story work is that you're going along with Miles, and at first you may not have a lot of sympathy for his situation because of everything I just described. He's a bit of a wet blanket, and, you know, how do you...
He's not likable.
No. And then, but then suddenly he's presented with a very giant challenge in the form of another version of himself has taken his place. And I think you start to, get caught up in his story and his struggle there because it's compelling. What would happen if you were replaced by another you? However, then we start telling the story from New Miles's perspective. And to me, that is, in a way, at least as interesting, if not more so, because his problem is that he is not who he thinks he is. In other words, he doesn't, when this happens, he has no idea. He wakes up after the spa and thinks, wow, I feel great. And he goes to work and he comes home and he has a wonderful, night with his wife. And then in the middle of the night, this other him appears who's screaming at him about, what are you doing here? And he has no idea who this person is. So there's a process of there from his perspective of realizing, oh, you know, I am not who I think I am. And so that's a much bigger problem. Mm-hmm. And then he also doesn't have his life. You know, his wife, who he's very much in love with, even more in love with in a way, because he's not been there through a lot of the problems lately, at least sort of emotionally. You know, he's sort of new and open to the world. And so all of these things that has as this clone and a fresh version of himself found a really new love for suddenly is about to be snatched away from him. And what would that be like?
But he agrees to leave, right? So they kind of come to an agreement, the two. The original Miles, the dyspeptic Miles, basically forces him to leave the house. And he agrees amiably enough to do so.
Yeah,
for a little bit.
For a bit before he quickly realizes that flying off to Fiji, which is what they've proposed, is not really what he wants.
So he hangs around.
Yeah, and then that's where it gets much more complicated.
And funny and interesting and really poignant, actually.
Thank you. I mean, there were times where we were filming, and I think Paul Rudd gives an incredible performance. And we'd be on set, and there would be 100 people around, and I wrote the story, so I know it's all make-believe. And he'd be doing a scene, and I would find myself really emotionally caught up. Like, usually for New Miles, I would be heartbroken.
Really?
Over some of the situations New Miles would find himself in.
Like what?
Well, first of all, when he first realizes he's a clone, and, there's a scene in the forest where he sort of looks down at his sort of lower stomach and realizes that he doesn't have a scar from an appendectomy that he should have if he were real. I originally wrote that more as a joke, like you sort of see him looking down his pants and you think it's sort of some kind of a blue joke about, something different down there. But the way Paul played it really broke my heart, that's the moment where he realizes I am not who I think I am, and thus my wife is not really my wife and all of these things. And I came up to him right after that take, was like, I'm so sad now. I didn't realize this would be such a sad moment.
And Paul Rudd, so you can tell the difference between the two, because at least physically you can tell the difference.
Yeah, I mean, we do remarkably little to him. That was like an incredibly, so much of that was just in his performance.
So when he's playing the original Miles, the schlubby Miles, he's schlubby looking. His hair is a mess. His clothes are kind of rumpled. His posture is bent.
Yeah. I mean, I would also say, though, that like if you look at, for those of you, if you see the show, there's a scene in the diner, in a diner where they're facing each other and they're talking. And, the shots are sort of similar, and so you cut right back and forth. Even on set, it looked like the shape of his face was different. And I know that all he did was walk off Miles basically just didn't have makeup. That was pretty much it. So he'd walk off set as new Miles, come back 10 minutes later with the makeup gone, and then he'd be Miles. And I swear, like, it looks like his whole jawline is different, and he just looks like a completely different person. I mean, they are still the same person, the same DNA, and I think that was important to not bring them too far apart either, because I've seen that done in doubling things and I don't really buy the connection. But it was just amazing how through posture and other things he was really able to get them to feel like two unique individuals who did obviously share the DNA.
Yeah. How did you prepare him for that, to play these two different characters?
He and I read through the scripts early on, like before he had fully committed, like I was reading lines with him, which for me was a surreal experience because I'd never done anything like this at all before, much less sit with Paul Rudd and read lines, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we'd go through the scripts and we'd talk about them, but also he'd talk about things from his life that reminded him of New Miles or Miles. Later, once Jonathan and Valerie got on, they did some performance work with him in that way, but I think it was really led by Paul. They basically allowed him the space to decide how he wanted to work. And, you know, we kind of worked it out both technically and just in terms of him building a character.
And I found myself, as you say, feeling badly for the clone, but also being kind of mad at Miles for being such a loser.
Yeah.
Like, why can't he get his act together?
Yeah. I mean, that's fair. And I was always aware of like that first stretch of the first episode that the audience is, for some reason, has got to go with this character for a bit because otherwise you may not like him. The fact that Paul Rudd is playing it helps a lot.
Yeah.
You know,
he's likable.
Yeah. I mean, you come in with such goodwill towards him that I feel like you're willing to watch the schmo version of Paul Rudd for a little bit.
Yeah. And I guess you do want him to get it together. And so you're committed to that, or you're in for that.
I hope so. I mean, I do think that once he's presented with somebody's taken my life, that you start to care a lot more about his situation. But also that's why we show New Miles. For a while, I think your heart is with New Miles.
Yeah.
Because he's sort of the innocent here and he is just somebody you would want to hang around with. But as the story goes on, I think your allegiances might switch somewhat. And hopefully by the end, well, people can feel however they want, but I at least feel a little more balanced by the end. Like I love them both, and I hope that they both, everything else works out at the end
and
for all of them.
Will the three of them live happily ever after?
No, they won't, because there's no such thing. So, no, I think that whatever, you know, in the imagined future world of these characters, I think that they have only scratched the surface of their challenges, honestly. Like, they haven't killed one another, so they've gotten that far in terms of answering how do you live with yourself, but there's a lot more to it than that. You know, there's a lot more to it than just staying alive, and it's about how do you exist in the world? How do you act with others, your loved ones? And I think that they've really only begun to answer that question at the end of the season.
Yeah, because we all do have different sides of ourselves that we present at different moments. And
yeah. Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
And sometimes the good is not so good.
Yeah. Yeah. Even when you think it is, and then you look back later and go, oh, that was terrible.
Timothy Greenberg, writer and creator of the new series Living With Yourself. Check it out on Netflix. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Jonathan Van Ness, the style guy on Queer Eye, on his life off screen.
How much I am worth to myself and to others in my community is not based on like how my outfit is, but it is like a fun way to play, and it's like a fun medium to like express yourself, but it's not like what my worth is.
Jonathan Van Ness talks about battling drug addiction and coming out as HIV positive next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Jonathan Van Ness has become a spokesperson for positivity, self-care, and catchphrases on Netflix's Queer Eye.
Can you believe?
That smell of cigarette wafting off your beard is so hot.
Yes, queen!
Jonathan Van Ness is the show's grooming expert, and he's also a podcast host. He's a gymnastics and figure skating super fan and now an author. His new memoir is called Over the Top, A Raw Journey to Self-Love. Jonathan Van Ness joins me now. And just a note to our listeners, we will talk about things that are sensitive topics, drug abuse and sex abuse and things like that. So you're warned. Hi there.
Hi.
Thank you for coming in today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So why did you want to write a memoir?
I think that it was almost like a way of kind of processing like the pace and the life shift that I've experienced in this last year. And I guess it'll be 2 years in February. But even prior to that, like I booked Queer Eye in February of 2017. And I started writing it like the end of like the summer of 18, 17. Mm-hmm. My years get so jumbled. Mm-hmm. It's been so busy.
Yeah.
But it was really kind of just as experiencing, like, you know, when Game of Thrones came out, there was like years where I really wanted to be successful. And I did Game of Thrones, and then I started getting curious, and I was loving that life, and I loved working at the salon. And I was, you know, hoping, though, for this time that I would find my vehicle and kind of find, like, what was going to take me from doing hair full time into, like, an entertainment career full time. And I didn't really know, like, if that would happen or, but that was, you know, what I really felt like I wanted. And then when Queer Eye happened and I booked it and it became this, you know, massive success and, like, all my dreams came true kind of overnight, I was like, oh, okay, like, everything that I had been raging about and upset about and wanting to talk about for so long, whether it was like in therapy or, you know, on Twitter or the things that shape like what I want to talk about on Getting Curious, just the way that I view the world. It was like, I have this massive platform now to be able to talk about like how hard it was for me when I got HIV and how hard it was for me to like navigate the ADEP and Ryan White funding and Medi-Cal and figure out how to sign up for the ACA and the subsidies. Like once mm-hmm. that kind of came into mm-hmm. fruition, like, everything that I've kind of went through in my life that I talk about in the book, like the difficult things, I always felt that those things that made me like keenly abnormal and destined to not succeed, I thought they made me like permanently not fixable, whatever mm-hmm. that meant. Mm-hmm. And I've really found that that was always such like a confine to my imagination. And so I really felt like I wanted to be able to talk about that and help other people that felt like they were at places that were like left them kind of too broken to get back up.
So I guess what I'm hearing from you is it's kind of like a way for you to figure out everything that's happened with you. And it's a lot. You're only in your early 30s and so much has happened to you. But also as a way to tell other people, hey, if any of you are struggling with any one of these things or all of these things or some of these things, then you're not alone.
Yeah.
Kind of a combination of that.
Yeah.
When did you figure out that you weren't alone?
Oh, man. Well, it's weird because now I like being alone. Like, I talk about that in the book. Like, when I was younger, I always felt like I couldn't be alone and I was terrified to be alone. Like, I actually quite, like, love my solitude now and, like, really enjoy, like, my quiet time with myself. Like, I'm more of a fan of myself than I've ever been. But I think I realized that I wasn't totally alone in a lot of different aspects of my life in different times in different areas, but it kind of like highlighted the layeredness of my existence. Like, for instance, in the book, I talk about, you know, being able to play dress up with my cousins until my dad walks in on it this one particular time.
And what did he say?
He like pulled me out of this dress and just kind of was like, you can't play dress up. It was this thing. And in order for you to play dress up afterwards, like we had to do it like under time and under kind of lock and key. Like we had to kind of know where he was in the golf course.
And how old were you?
Like three.
Three.
Yeah.
And you couldn't play dress up.
Yeah. I knew really early that my like affinity for Barbies and dress up and evening gowns and Miss America was really problematic around adult men. But I knew that around like my aunt and, you know, these cousins, I could kind of get away with it.
And
but
your mom?
Yeah. I mean, we didn't have dress up gorgeous clothes at my house being the youngest of three boys, but at my aunt's house we did. And I think my mom always was trying to figure out how to mitigate and mediate that, you know, visceral reaction that my dad had and like how to let me explore and be seen and safe. And my dad's really such an incredible dad now. He's really come around a lot.
Then you apologized?
Yes. It's been very life affirming for my dad to apologize on certain things. I think I say this like kind of jokingly, but also kind of seriously. He had like four strokes in 2016 coming out of knee surgery. And I think that there was something about having these strokes that really softened him.
Mm. Like I said, you've been through a lot in your young life, beginning, as you talk about in the book, so I'm going to raise it now, being sexually abused as a young, young child by another child, but a much older child, right? And that really stuck with you for a long time and was the origin of a lot of the problems that you had later with binging and purging, with drug abuse, with becoming a sex worker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that it blurred what I went through as a child and being a survivor of sexual abuse. It blurred, you know, my ability to set boundaries and my ability to know kind of what my worth was and how I wanted to. I think, you know, no children's worlds are ready to be painted with those colors at that age. You can have like 10 people incur a very similar type of abuse and they will all deal with it in different ways. Mm-hmm. I think that the effects of my abuse kind of ballooned and mushroomed and the ripples of them, you know, went much further into my life because of the silence and the shame and the secrecy around dealing with it in the first place and like throughout my life. And that was a lot of why I wanted to talk about it in this book, because I think being a survivor of sexual abuse is really common, but talking about it is not really common.
When did you first start talking about it?
Well, in the book, I talk about how I told a trusted therapist about it when I was like a teenager, and I kind of shelved it again. And that was such a terrifying experience, like kind of telling a trusted adult about it and having it be thrust into this, you know, pseudo public light. And no one really knows how to deal with that. In a family, it's really intense when...
Because the boy was punished, right? Well, I guess he was not a boy anymore at that point.
Yeah, like my family was like, the reaction was like, let's, you know, deal with this. Like internally, we don't want this to be this like public thing. And it left me with all these messages of like more shame and more secrecy. And that really took me like 7-8 years of really self-destructive behavior to kind of unpack. You know, I really, like, I graduated early from high school. I, you know, kind of went to Arizona, where I immediately kind of fell into sex work and abusing drugs. And I think that the sexual abuse definitely led to a lot of those things. But I think that the most damaging thing about the sexual abuse wasn't the abuse. It was the silence mm-hmm. and the isolation that I incurred because of what happened. And I think that that's true of a lot of people. Because if I would have been able to have had an adult that really heard and saw and was able to deal with that situation adequately when it was like first rise, I think that a lot of these things could have been avoided. For survivors of abuse, myself included, talking about it is something that can be kind of re-traumatizing for other people listening. It's definitely traumatizing for me to talk about it, which is why I kind of wrote about it in the book.
So you wrote about it so you wouldn't have to talk about it.
Yeah, exactly. And to kind of be able to leave some of those difficult things and how they affected me in that book, and let people that are going through their own experiences take it for what it is and take what works for them and leave what doesn't.
Mm. Well, about your HIV status, and you were diagnosed when you were 25.
Mm-hmm.
Did you worry that being public with that would affect the show in any way? Did you worry about that?
Not the show so much as myself, because of the nature of where we are in the medical science of HIV. Like, it's not something that you can be cured from at the present moment. So I knew that once I was public about my status, that that would be something that I wouldn't be able to kind of take back. And I didn't want to come into this moment kind of becoming kind of the poster child for that. And I was concerned that that would be like the only thing that anyone ever wanted to see me as or define me by if I talked about it earlier. As the success and experience of Queer Eye grew, and I saw the continued systematic attack on Planned Parenthood and just the continued really bad policy coming out of this administration around people living with HIV, from like the firing of the HIV AIDS Advisory Council in 2017 to like the attempted defunding of Planned Parenthood and the attempted dismantling of the Affordable Care Act, that I felt like it was really important for me to talk about it. But no one from the show would ever make me feel like I couldn't talk about it on the show. I mean, in season three, when we were working with Rob Elrod, who's an incredible father, whose wife passed away after a battle with breast cancer, I talked about my mom's battle with cancer. I talked about losing my stepdad to cancer, which were really personally hard things that I went through that I talk about in the book. So I think the show's always really supportive about like supporting us in what we, you know, want to talk about or not talk about. So really, I mean, no one has ever been anything other than extremely supportive of me and in every way on Queer Eye.
Mm. And so when you are an activist, you met with Nancy Pelosi, right, to talk about PrEP?
Mm-hmm. And the Equality Act.
Yeah. You're very obviously outspoken. Do you think that you could be more political on the show because you have such a huge audience to push these issues on the show?
Well, so when you shoot an episode of Queer Eye, we shoot like 60 hours of footage a week. So it has to fit into like 45 minutes. So I often, like with Jody, for instance, like I did her hair for 8 hours. Like we had like a hugely long conversation about mass incarceration, and she is a guard at a prison. And I took her on about like marijuana policy, how she feels about people that are being locked up in there for marijuana. With the Jones sisters, we talked a lot about their experiences growing up as one of the only African-American families, Black families in their community, and what that really meant during like schools coming together, because they were growing up like during the desegregation of like schools in Kansas City, Kansas. There are certain conversations that we can all have, but none of us are producers on the show. because I have heard that criticism and that question too, just like the angling of like, do you think that you could be more political in the face of just the climate at large and having this opportunity? But I think something that is kind of lost on viewers of Queer Eye in America is that Netflix is in 190 countries. The only countries where it's not is Sudan, North Korea, China, and Crimea. And so when you're exposing viewers in Lebanon, when you're exposing viewers in Saudi Arabia, parts of Africa, South America, Central America, we are not in some sort of, I mean, just the act of having still to this day in 2019, four gay men and my non-binary person is an act of political bravery and expression in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And I see those Twitter comments too. It's like, we could be edgier. And if it were up to me, I would, because I think that people can take it. And I think that we should do that. But I also am aware that there is other people that are just not as far along as we wish that people were. And I think that that is something that is like a reality that, you know, people that are, you know, on the production side of Queer Eye are like, we're all trying to grapple with.
Mm. I also think, you know, just people who don't know who you are and they just see you on Queer Eye and that's it, probably think, oh, well, he's just this guy who's interested in hair.
That's another reason why I wanted to write the book.
I mean, and here you are really politically engaged. And I think, you know, a lot of people are surprised that this is who you are.
Yeah. But I also think that the relationship that we
but also have, hair like, is very important.
Yeah, totally. And it's not even just hair. It's really like a feeling of well-being and like how, like what our relationship is to like what we look at in the mirror. We spend a lot of time with that person.
Mm-hmm.
That is kind of a, that's like a deep relish.
If you look in the mirror a lot.
Well, you have to kind of in the morning and at night. At some point, even if you stand over a puddle or go to a lake, like you're going to see yourself sometimes. And if that sight makes you really uncomfortable, no matter how little you look at it, that will affect your life in a deep, deep way.
But how do you thread the needle between that and just being too concerned with your looks and being too, I mean, there's a lot of narcissism in our culture now.
Yeah, I don't spend like a lot of time, like even now, like I'm like, I hope people don't think I don't have flyaways. I mean, like if you see me in the airport, like I totally have like a halo of frizz like all the time. Like I do my hair for like a photo shoot if I'm on camera, but I think all hairdressers are notorious for like, yes, I can style my own hair, but I'm not putting heat to it all the time, honey, because I'm doing your hair and I don't want to like deal with it. Because I'm like I'm always like running into the location that I need to be at because I was like doing someone's hair. I was like finishing a blow dry. Like I was always trying to help someone else. And so my aesthetic usually like, especially professionally, was like not on my radar until I started doing things on camera as much as I do now. But I always make this joke that like, because I was like a male cheerleader, it's like really hard to embarrass me. But like there are times where like I've worn like a really like I think about when I took Michelle Kwan to the GLAAD Awards, which was like on my 32nd birthday. It was this past March. I just like was not, I was so like taken aback with like Michelle Kwan being my date that like I forgot to pay attention to how I looked. And then the next day, this lady who does like a blog, like put me on her worst dress list from the GLAAD Awards. It was like, that dress was like a mess and like it was all wrinkly and I was like clearly not wearing makeup. And I was like, see, that's it. Like I have fun. Like I liked the dress. I had a cute little thing in the back of my hair. I did forget to do my makeup, but I just can't take it so personally because I did look kind of a mess, but I think it's all just fun. And that's how I thread the needle is it's like my worth and like how much I am worth to myself and to others in my community is not based on like how my outfit is, but it is like a fun way to play. And it's like a fun medium to like express yourself, but it's not like what my worth is. And if you run into me, like I always have frizz and I always have like a little bit of a dark circle because I like don't want to put on concealer, even though I did put on my eye cream today and I did put on like a nice BB cream for you. Even though we're on radio, I didn't want you to be like worried about the texture of my skin.
I'm not worried about
it. I know. I was just kidding.
It looks really good.
Thank you so much. So does yours.
Thank you. Jonathan Van Ness, grooming expert and so much more on Netflix's Queer Eye, author of the new memoir, Over the Top, A Raw Journey to Self-Love. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And Michelle Loy is here with some feedback. Hi.
Hi. Gas prices.
Hi.
Yeah. Hi.
Too damn high.
Hi, H-I-G-H. Yesterday, Governor Gavin Newsom announced that he wants an investigation into whether the big name gas stations are fixing their prices here. Mm. So for context, California's average price is about $4. The national average is $2.50.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So our reporter, Jerome Campbell, went out to this gas station near LACMA where prices were extremely high. He found Noah Eberhardt, a podcaster, on his way to work.
I only put 3 gallons in because it's so expensive, and I just need it to get me to work today and a few other places.
So we want to hear your gas stories. Share them. KCRW Press Play.
All right. Thank you, Michelle Aloy. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.